So this morning we're beginning a new series in the life of David. And the series I've titled, A Cloudless Morning. And it's a phrase that comes from 2 Samuel 23 in the midst of a song that David writes at the end of his life. As he's looking back and looking forward. And in that song, David says this, he writes this. When one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God, he dawns on them like the morning light, like the sun shining forth on a cloudless morning. And it's a striking picture, right? It's a metaphor. I mean, he's not kind of listing out a bunch of lists or rules. You don't find that kind of language in a policy manual or how to be a king manual. It's a description of what it's like. And what would it feel like to live in a kingdom in which the king's wisdom and rule is like a balmy, dry air, clear sky summer morning? What would it be like to live in that every day? Right, David's song there at the end of 2 Samuel speaks of the hope and the promise of a coming king whom we're going to meet, and is, it was talked about later in Malachi, one of the last prophet of the Old Testament. And Malachi says this, he's looking forward to, and he says that the Son of Righteousness, not S-O-N, S-U-N, the Son of Righteousness, right, who shall rise with healing in his wings. And John the Baptist's father in Luke, in the first part of Luke, he sings a song when John the Baptist is born, and his father, Zechariah, John the Baptist's father, says this. He says that the sunrise, not the S-O-N, the S-U-N, the sunrise shall visit us from on high. Now, in our passage this morning, we're invited to see the kind of person who is as different from the world as the nighttime is as different from the dawn, or the dawn is as different from the nighttime, much like using an optometrist's ferropter. Do you know that what's called that big thing that they put in front of you? It's called a ferropter. Much like using an optometrist's ferropter, by which they determine the kinds of glasses or lens corrections that we need in order to see clearly, we need to start our series on the study of David and his life to have our vision checked. And to begin to have that corrected so that we might see things as the Lord sees them. And as we look at 1 Samuel 16, verses 1 to 13, we're going to be looking at four things that prevent you from seeing and three things that you need in order to see. All right, firstly, let's start off. What are four things that prevent you from seeing? The first thing that prevents you from seeing as the Lord sees things is looking around to others. Now, this is not so specific in this passage. The book of Samuel begins by telling the story of Samuel's judgeship in Israel. It begins where the book of the Judges and the book of Ruth have left off. And over again in the book of Judges, you have this refrain that kind of comes up again and again, that in those days, Israel had no king and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. It speaks to the chaos and the lack of community and a cohesive rule over Israel. Everyone doing what was right in their own eyes. Now in Deuteronomy, the Lord is going to tell Moses, he's going to say that Israel's desire for a king reflects the fact that they have rejected the Lord himself, and that Moses shouldn't take it personally when he rejects, when they reject him. Now, it's assumed that Israel's desire for a king was a bad thing, and that's not true. Israel's desire for a king was right. Israel needed a king. They need a king. However, they wanted a king like the nations had. And to have a king like the nations have would be to have a ruler who, along with the other rulers of the nations, like in Psalm 2, that we read about, a ruler who would rise up and take counsel together with the other kings against the Lord. Israel needs a king. They need the Lord's anointed, but they can't see. And for us, it's true that our desire, the things that we want and things that we know that we need, coupled with our envying of others, blinds us. And Israel is often blinded in this way, okay, because they're looking at others, they're envying others, and they're not willing or ready to receive what the Lord has for them. The second thing that prevents you from seeing, them from seeing, is that you can't see if you're looking over your shoulder. We're often unable to get the good thing that the Lord has to offer us, that he brings to us and places right in front of us because of regret. First and Second Samuel tell the story of two kings, Israel's first two kings. In each of these stories of King Saul and this other king that we're going to study, in each of their stories, these kings have promising beginnings. But both kings fall into sin and to disobedience. One king is able to recover, and another is not able to recover. What's the difference? Why? Well, the second king, who is able to recover, is able to recover because he comes to terms with his failure and sin. He turns to the Lord. The first king, who was not able to recover, he won't recover. He's unable to come to terms with the ways in which he has failed, and the ways in which he has sinned. By this point in 1 Samuel 16, that first king, King Saul, has already failed. And you can read about that in 1 Samuel 15. And in it, Saul refuses to repent. And that refusal of repenting is the cause and the sign that the Lord has rejected him. King Saul is one of the Bible's great examples of a person who succumbs to debilitating regret, right? They're an unrepentant sorrow. The Apostle Paul in Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians, calls it worldly grief or worldly sorrow, a worldly grief that produces death. It's the regret of Esau, who you read about in Genesis, who sold his birthright to Jacob, his brother, for a bowl of beans, and then later felt bad about it or regretted it. Worldly regret is the regret of Judas, who tried to return the blood money by which he sold the Lord Jesus. Worldly regret, right, this living with the pressure and the condemnation and the judgment and the shame of how it is that you failed in the past, it is particularly insidious because it actually flows out of a self-regard. Right? Your failures, your powerlessness over sin or sins, your inability to live up to the standard that you yourself imagine you being able to live up to, failing to live up to that can crush you. Worldly sorrow it debilitates you. And if you find yourself, right, you know, oh, I'm just an awful person, oh, I can't do these things, you need to ask yourself, have you forgotten that Jesus knows all of your sin? And that even his dying, his salvation that he has accomplished for you is not only for those sins that you've come to realize that you've committed, but even for the sins that you haven't realized or don't realize yet. Right? He died for those sins. Nobody's sin surprises them as much. No one is so much surprised at their sin as they are, right? I can't believe I did that. We have a saying at Grace to combat worldly sorrow and regret. When I'm discouraged, right? When I'm defeated because I failed again and sinned again in the same ways, one of you will look at me and I'm like, I'm just an awful person. I can't believe I'm a pastor. One of you will look at me and say, cheer up. You're worse than you think. I'm glad some of you are laughing. Right? Some people are just like, that's awful. But see, what it does is it exposes that self-regard. And it's intended to shine a light on the reality that Jesus is not surprised. Sorrow and regret over one's sins and failures, that it turns inward on oneself, and it fails to actually take into account the offense or the woundedness of the other person against whom you've sinned. It's, I can't believe I'm this awful of a person, but we don't think about how it's dishonored God. We're not sorrowful for the person that we've wounded. Cheer up, you're worse than you think, reminds me that it's not about us. And there's a tag that goes on to that, right? So it's not just cheer up, you're worse than you think. It's you're more loved than you ever dared imagine. And that's the gospel, right? That's what we need to see. So that's the second thing, okay? Looking over your shoulder, tripped up by regret. The third thing that keeps you from seeing is an unwillingness to accept that things have in fact changed. Right? In spite of his great exasperation with King Saul and Saul's bullheaded oafishness, Samuel can't seem to come to terms that things have changed. Samuel hasn't come to terms that things have changed. Saul has so much potential. He just can't keep it together. Saul worshiped and sacrificed to God on his own terms. He takes things on his own terms. He does not listen to the Lord. He does not obey the Lord. He lies about his actions and then refuses to take responsibility for them. What is it that you can do with that sort of person? Right? Saul seems so promising. Saul was a warrior. He led Israel against the Philistines. And surprisingly, he didn't seem to have great ambitions about himself. He looked like a king. We read that when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upwards. That's where we get that they stand a head above, right? They're head and shoulders above. That's where that expression comes from. Samuel said of him, there's none like him among all the people. And Samuel just can't see how it is that Saul could have turned out so bad. And so our chapter in 16 begins with the Lord asking Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul? The Lord says to Samuel, I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons. Now, that sounds like good news, but it reveals something of Samuel's deeper problem, and it's a fourth thing that keeps me from seeing, is that you don't see because you're ignoring what you already do see. You won't accept that things have changed, and the thing that is obviously standing in front of you, you refuse to look at and acknowledge. Not only is Samuel grieving over he thought Saul could have been and isn't, he does in fact see the sort of person that Saul actually is. How can I go? If Saul hears of it, he will kill me. Right? Even though the Lord has chosen another, if Samuel anoints another, it won't negate the fact that Israel still has a king and that Saul is that king. Saul, Samuel knows, is a violent man. And you can't have two kings at the same time. The only way a new king gets to be crowned is if somebody's died, and Samuel does not want that person to be him. So, right, we're envious of others. We're looking over our shoulders at the would-haves and the could-haves and the should-haves. And then, we even pull the wool over our own eyes. And this leads us to, secondly, what we need now to, in order to see. Firstly, in order to see, you need to know and you need to recognize at the very start that we are notoriously bad at seeing. Today we call it bias, all the different kinds of bias. Michael Lewis, the author, in his book Moneyball, he's written this book about the Oakland A's, made into a movie, about the Oakland A's baseball team manager Billy Beane and his remarkable achievement of making the Oakland A's contenders, even though they didn't have the financial resources that the Boston Red Sox or the New York Yankees did. You know, he made them contenders. And he finds himself, because he's got these reduced resources, he finds himself at odds with his recruiting scouts. Billy Beane, he recognized, not only you know because it was out there, but through his own personal experience, that potentiality is not the same thing as reality. That statistics can be used to prove anything, and that the sort of statistics that baseball statisticians collected were oftentimes things that did not measure anything that had to do with whether or not a team was going to make it to the playoffs or be successful or win games. It did not, those statistics did not do anything to predict a player's value as a productive member of a baseball team. Now Billy Beane knew that his baseball scouts swooned over players that Billy calls body players. They look the part, he says. They look so good on the field, swinging a bat, running bases. Right? They look so good that they have to be thoroughbred champions. But looking good is not the same thing as getting on base and scoring runs, and frankly, that's the statistic that counts the most. It's really the only one that counts. Billy would say, we're not asking these players to sell genes. Billy would say to his scouts, right? He would say that to his scouts. Saul was a body player. Samuel is wistfully, right? He's looking over his shoulder at the would-haves and the could-haves. But the Lord wants to show him something more. And Samuel's not going to be able to see it until the Lord reveals it to him. Now, this is the thing for you. What if you don't see things? Could you ask yourself the question, maybe you don't see things as clearly as you think that you see them. I'm not inviting you into a great season of doubt. What I'm asking you of you is, can you turn to the Lord and say, Lord, I need you to help me to see? Okay, because that really is the first step. That's always the first step. I need the Lord to show me, and Samuel needs the Lord to show him. So having asked that Jesse be present for the sacrifice and for Jesse to bring his sons with him, we read that in verse 6 that when they came, he looked at Eliab and he thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before me. Eliab looks the guy like the guy. Eliab is the firstborn. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look upon his appearance or his height or his stature. Saul had the look. Eliab's got the look too. How could it not be him? In all, right, in that series of events, right, in all, 7 princely sons are offered, a whole week of opportunity. Each one lookers, each one a body player. But we learn that the Lord has not chosen these. Okay. So we need the Lord to show us. Because we're notoriously bad. We're fundamentally flawed at seeing. Secondly, if we're to truly see, we need to know that the Lord sees not as man sees. If you are going to see, you need to see this, that you don't see what the Lord sees. Samuel has asked to see Jesse's sons. Jesse has brought to Samuel 7 sons. And if ever there were a number of sons that would lead you to say, I've seen them all, it would be to have been brought 7 sons. Surely that's all. But he's met with the Lord's command to anoint a son of Jesse. And the Lord's revelation that each of these sons are not the one, Samuel has this choice now. He's confronted. He's with this moment. Right? He's been brought seven sons. The Lord is not this one. The Lord is not this one. The Lord is not this one. Now he's at an impasse. It doesn't add up. And rather than assume, right, that there's been faulty math, he's counted wrong, he's wrongly heard what it is that the Lord said, or he's imagined that the Lord's instruction was somehow flawed, he does something remarkable. It's the most remarkable thing in the passage. He asks a question. Are these all your sons? Now, do you realize what a ridiculous question that is? For Samuel's part, it all hinges on him humbling himself and asking the question, admitting that he doesn't know something, that he doesn't see what the Lord's doing, and it's an act of faith. Samuel's not able to put it together, but it's coupled with a faithful obedience, and it works in him and out of him as a question, and it leads to a pivotal turn. It's a pivotal turn in his life, and it's a pivotal turn in the life of Israel, and it is a pivotal turn in the life of all those who have placed their faith in the Son of this next person. Okay? He asked this question. So if you want to see, you've got to admit that you don't see. And then you've got to ask the awkward question. Are all your sons here? What kind of question is that? Samuel asks that Jesse be present and bring his sons for the sacrifice. Surely Jesse understands the request. Certainly Jesse would have all of his sons present. Who asked a father to bring all of his sons, right? You've asked the father to bring all of his sons, and then you turn to the father and say, are there any more? It's just remarkable. And Jesse said, there remains yet the youngest. Behold, that's a great word, lo, right? Behold. I mean, that's a turn. But behold, he is keeping the sheep. Now, apparently, Jesse didn't clearly follow the instructions or closely follow them. Maybe it was too much trouble to send for the youngest who was in the field watching the sheep. You know, there's no telling what the reason would be, but maybe Jesse thought that the youngest in terms of appearance or the height of his stature. Maybe Jesse sees as man sees, looking at the outward appearance. But this youngest son is the eighth son. I hope that kind of, you know, if you know me, and if you don't know me, you should ask that question because we would talk a lot about it. But he's the eighth son. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and get him, for we will not sit down until he comes here. And it should be noted, right, that Samuel has to wait until he is able to see. Right? So he knows there's an answer, but now he has to wait for its fulfillment. And let me just say, patience. Patience isn't a lesson that you have to learn in order to be good enough to get the blessing that God doesn't really want to give you. That's not what patience is. The work and the waiting of patience is the kind of faith that you need to have in order to receive the blessing that the Lord has for you. It's the kind of faith that you need to have. Now, after waiting, and who knows for how long, Samuel finally gets to see the Lord's anointed. And up to this point, we haven't heard his name in this narrative. His name hasn't come up. It's a brilliant bit of storytelling. When the boy finally does come to Samuel, we read that the young man had beautiful eyes and was handsome. It wasn't the lad's stature that set him apart. It was something that was perceived beneath, something about his character. His eyes were bright and he was handsome. That word is tob in the Hebrew, which doesn't mean merely handsome, it means good. Something good that they saw. And you know who else is described as Tob? Moses. That's a hint. And the Lord said, arise and anoint him, for this is he. Now, even after Samuel anoints him, we don't know who it is. We know he's the youngest son, that he's a shepherd, that he's come in from the field. It's only the narrator who lets us know, and he says that the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. David. Finally, we get to his name. And do you know what his name means? Beloved. It means beloved. Friends, as we work through Samuel this fall, we're going to be invited to behold the Lord's beloved. And it isn't ultimately David that we're going to be invited to look at. It is the son of David. But in order for us to see the beloved of God, we need to have our vision corrected so that we might see things as the Lord sees. And in seeing the true son of David, Jesus Christ, the anointed, the Messiah, the son of righteousness who has come with healing in his wings, who has dawned upon us, and dawns upon those who receive his kingdom, right? Whose rule and reign is like living under a cloudless morning. The true Son of David, Jesus Christ, has come to find us and to rename us. He takes away our name of regret, of sinner, of stubborn, of can't see it. And he wins for us the name Beloved of God.